You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. I am very proud to talk about Audible. I've been using Audible probably since they've been around. I don't know when they started, but I think it's a great company. Who has time to read a book? Most of us don't. You have time to listen to a book, though. If you're working out in the gym, if you're doing house chores, if you're in your car, this is how you become well-read. And Audible, I think, is it's the best company I know of. They got over 150,000 titles to choose from every genre. I think they got like over 100,000 hours of audio programs from 270 content providers. It's everything. I mean, audiobook, publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine, newspaper publishers. It just goes on and on, okay? And I mean, I think they have over 1,000 science and technology and science fiction, 1,100 science fiction and fantasy titles. It's unbelievable. And they're always adding, and they got great actors and really good readers. I don't know how they screen these people, but it really makes certain books. I think it's better for a lot of books to be listened to, in fact. I think you get more from it. Here's the good news. You get a free audiobook download when you sign up for a free trial today. You go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS and you will get a free audiobook. How's that sound? It really is a great company. I do not allow anybody to sponsor me that I don't believe in, and I think this is an amazing company. So I'm proud. Thank you, Audible, for sponsoring The Brian Callen Show. And let me say this one more time. Go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS for The Brian Callen Show, and you will get a free audiobook today. Thank you. And now back to the show. And, you know, it's a bunch of young entrepreneurs saying, hey, why do restaurants have to look this way? Let's change the whole look of this, and let's fry okra and mix it with, you know, pineapple and you know, tradition be damned. And DC, man, I hadn't been there probably in 20 years, 15 years, and it has not moved. Innovation goes there to die.
That used to be the case. I think in the last 2 years, that's shifted tremendously, but I know exactly
good.
What you mean. I mean, I grew up in this area, and you're right. It was the reason why I left the town was because it was had all the innovation of, like, you know, a block of wood.
I know some pretty innovative pieces of wood, Andrew, you know.
all the innovation of a block of wood. Our distinguished guest is Andrew Lee. And do you spell it? It's spelled L-I-H.
And it's pronounced Lee, right? Sorry.
Okay. Which would indicate probably that it's a low tone in Cantonese.
Hello.
That's a very nice guess. But it's actually a very weird, unusual Chinese character, which is why it's spelled uniquely like that. Hmm. But it's pronounced Lee.
What does it mean in Chinese? Smart as shit?
No, not really. It's actually based on the Chinese character for deer.
That's cool.
It's kind of a weird ancient Chinese name that we're not even sure exactly where it came from.
Wow, because Brian Callen is the Gaelic for wolf. I have no idea. I name my son Finn, though, because that's Gaelic for the triangular growth that juts out of a shark's back. You wrote a book, The Wikipedia Revolution, and it's fascinating, and I have so many questions because we really are living at a time when I think the Encyclopedia Britannica, for example, they would get some distinguished professor or some distinguished expert on something, and they would write their sort of blurb on whatever the subject was. We are living in a time when Wikipedia is sort of a living, breathing organism. It's always changing. It's always sort of self-correcting. You've got 1,000 eyeballs on it. One of the things that I noticed, Andrew, is when I was doing the Joe Rogan podcast about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I was so free with my information. I was just dropping what I thought was knowledge and my opinions. Problem was, There were about 100,000 people listening, and now there are about 8 million. But I would get these tweets and these emails saying, you don't know what you're talking about, man. You know, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And be more careful with your information. It was a huge wake-up call for me. So now when I do these podcasts and I interview people like yourself, I've learned to be very careful with what I say without, you know, thank God for Wikipedia and Google.
Right.
So
yeah, I mean, basically nothing you can say these days goes uncommented or without any pushback, right? So as you said, you've got Wikipedia at your fingertips, you've got Twitter in the back channel, you've got all kinds of things that are now keeping folks accountable for what they're saying. And it's a very different landscape to have that.
What got you to write the book?
So I was looking for, in 2003, the next interesting thing to look at in terms of citizen journalism or participatory journalism. So by that time, you know, blogs were fairly well known, but I was looking for something more interesting to study than blogs. And one of my buddies, who I was having lunch with, said, oh, you got to take a look at this site called Wikipedia. And I've never heard of this site called Wikipedia, and very few people actually had back in 2003. And he said it was a encyclopedia where anyone can edit any page at any time. And I thought he was exaggerating until we brought it up on his laptop screen, and in fact, anyone could edit any page at any time. You didn't need to register. You didn't need to enter a login or a password. You could just look at the page, hit the edit button, and modify anything on the page. And of course, when you see that and you hear about it, it sounds completely insane to open up a site for anyone to edit without any registration. And I went back to my office later that day, and I started looking through it, and I said, you know what, actually, this content's good. It's not just good, it's really good, and I can't believe this actually works. So anytime you see something that shouldn't work but does, that's a pretty good indication you should look deeper into it or do some research about it. And that's what I started to do.
Yeah, it raises incredible questions because, you know, your first reaction and mine when I found out about Wikipedia was, I'm not going to go on the internet to get my information because a bunch of, and you say it. I mean, how, it's the Wikipedia revolution, but it's how a bunch of nobodies created the world's greatest encyclopedia. Which is, you know, when you read that, you go, I'm not going to trust that source of information. I need erudite, you know, scholars who've done all the primary research before I start, you know, and that's who I'm turning to for my information. But in fact, we're talking about the wisdom of crowds here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the fact that most people are ethical. Most people are in earnest and do the and if you have enough people contributing to a site, it filters down to the actual truth, which is actually pretty eye-opening for me.
Right. I mean, I think you hit on the head. That was one of the early mantras of Wikipedia when it was started, which was that most people are good and that a few people spoil the pot for everyone else. So as long as you can kind of keep those folks from either having dominance in the community or causing any mayhem, just open up the whole system and allow more and more people to participate. That'll lead to growth. That'll lead to better quality. That'll lead to things that you never thought could happen with this crowd. And that's when you start to see all these different projects started within the Wikipedia community. You know, originally in Wikipedia, there were very few or almost no pictures. Now, you go to pretty much any article and you see illustrations, pictures, information boxes, tables, diagrams, things like that. And those were all done just simply because people thought it would be a good idea and they just started off in their little corner of Wikipedia.
So awesome.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that I just loved in the book, because, you know, I work with students all the time and, you know, there are so many teachers out there who are like, you know, you can't use Wikipedia as a source. But the reality is that Wikipedia is more accurate than Encyclopedia Britannica.
Or the teacher.
Or, you know, there. I mean, isn't that true?
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite things, because I was one of the first people to actually do academic research about Wikipedia or even to talk about it. And when I used to go to universities, I would always get this kind of love-hate relationship with the faculty members I talked to because they all couldn't stand Wikipedia being constantly cited by their students over and over again. On the other hand, they really liked Wikipedia as a practical matter, right? There's no better place to go to on the internet to start off knowing nothing about something and walking out at the end knowing pretty much all the important things or at least important references on a topic. And that's why it's so popular with journalists, students, pretty much anyone who is interested in learning something, finds something that they can get excited about in Wikipedia. So my advice to students always is there's no better starting point for research than Wikipedia, but there's no worse ending point for research than Wikipedia. So,
why is that?
So you never take anything that you read in Wikipedia as the gospel. But you notice that in the last few years, Wikipedia now is crazy about references and citations, right? So when you read Wikipedia now, you see superscripts everywhere, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all these references and footnotes. And that's a big change because Wikipedia started off in the early days in 2001 to 2003 as just getting stuff in there. It wasn't too concerned about referencing every single thing that's in there. But over the last 10 years, they're so popular and they're so relied upon by so many folks that they start to realize that verification, citing your sources, references, and the fact that if you get something wrong about someone who's alive, it could really affect their reputation and livelihood. So their standard for making sure that you can prove things that are right in Wikipedia has gone up tremendously, to the point where now Wikipedia has a really, really high bar in terms of including stuff that's accurate.
And we've really seen, I mean, that's the interesting thing. Wikipedia has really sort of evolved almost in a biological sense, right? I mean, the sense that it just gets, you know, there are new features being added all the time. You know, it's developing. The articles get more specific. I think there are certain articles that are now sort of hallmark articles that are kind of locked almost because they've sort of reached completion in a weird sense.
Right. That's a great point. One of the things that we see now in English Wikipedia today, you have 4.4 million articles, which is about 10 times bigger than your typical encyclopedia, right? So if you look at Encarta, when that was alive, when Microsoft took that, had that dominant online encyclopedia, when you had Britannica, if you had maybe 300,000 to 400,000 articles, that was seen as kind of a complete encyclopedia or pretty comprehensive. You know, English language Wikipedia is 4.4 million and growing. So that's a much larger pool of articles. It's a lot much larger responsibility out there. But it also means that it's that much harder to add the next article in Wikipedia because I don't want to say everything under the sky has been written about, but the large chunk of common knowledge about what we know has been written about in some way or another on Wikipedia. Now, there are significant holes that need improvement, but it is tougher for the average person to find something meaningful to contribute to Wikipedia unless it's, you know, the death of Seymour, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, or the new CEO of Microsoft that was just appointed yesterday. So those current events articles, yeah, we need people to do that. But in terms of history of World War II, things that are in the past, those have been very, very deeply researched and written. And that's something that the Wikipedia community is now dealing with, is how is this community to update Wikipedia sustainable going forward if these articles, as you said, are getting locked down or are more and more complete? There's not a lot of easy ways to contribute.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And what does it say about, I know you're an authority on internet censorship in the People's Republic of China. It's very difficult, obviously, in today's day and age to keep information from the people. I'm sure China deals with this every single day, and I'm amazed that they still are doing their best to, you know, and like as governments do, especially communist governments or authoritarian governments, they're doing their best to keep the information out of the people's hands, or at least censor it, corral it, shepherd it. Are they losing that battle?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's a compliment I hate to give to the government in China, but they've been extremely effective in over a decade keeping the lid on the internet. Or I should say, it's kind of like the Three Gorges Dam that they created, which is like trying to harness the power of the internet while keeping certain unwanted cultural effects, put to the side. And they've done a pretty good job with that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So the strange story related to China and the firewall, or the Great Firewall, was that I wrote most of the book while I was based in Beijing, China.
Mm.
My wife was working for the Wall Street Journal as a reporter, and I took off, 2 years to write the book and to do other things. But the funny thing is that Wikipedia was officially blocked in China during the time I was there in Beijing.
Amazing.
Now, the funny thing is that if you're just somewhat technically savvy, it's trivial to bypass that block.
Mm-hmm. Is it really?
VPN. Yeah,
is?
You use a VPN, use a proxy server, you can, subscribe to a service for like $3 to $4 a month, and it's easy to just get past the censorship in China.
Do people do that?
They do.
Okay.
The thing is that probably only, 2 to 5% of internet users in China use any kind of circumvention technologies. It's not because it's dangerous to do so. It's just that, it's just too much of a hassle to have to fire up the software and to...
Well, included in that 2 and 5% are probably officials in the government, right? I mean,
right.
I mean that's what I'm always hopeful of is that ideas, the way you beat a bad idea is with a better idea. And
right.
So if you're, I don't care how powerful you are, provided you're not a sociopath, but for the most part, I think that most people in the government of China are in earnest and doing their best to kind of create a prosperous nation.
Right.
You know, the more that they are exposed to these ideas and, I guess, the truth, as it were, the collective truth, especially about how the world is working, at least it must spark debate among the elite, among the power brokers, I think.
I think the informed, certainly, right? So you have folks who have either gone to school overseas and
right.
returned to China. But, you know, it's kind of the same as in the U.S., right? You have an elite of 2 to 4% of the U.S., perhaps, that, you know, feel passionately about certain civil liberties or the things that are wrong with the U.S., but the bulk of the people are interested more in The Bachelor or American Idol or twerking. And
yeah.
the same thing is kind of true in China.
Yeah.
culture and...
Well, twerking is... Yeah.
Twerking is really one of those universal things that draws humanity together.
We got to dedicate a podcast just to twerking, but keep going.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the funny thing is that just like in the U.S., whatever is easy and glitters in front of your eyeballs is going to be what 90% of the people are interested in.
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. And that's really no different whether you go from U.S. to China. And that's basically what you find in China, is that the internet content there that's geared towards Chinese users, whether it's a video sharing service or peer-to-peer networks or their social networking sites, they're all based in China, and they're not really that interesting. I mean, they're blocked from Facebook, they're blocked from Twitter, they're blocked from YouTube. But on the other hand...
Are they blocked from all those?
They are. I mean, that's the funny thing. So it's the interesting thing about that is not necessarily because the Chinese government is scared of Chinese citizens learning about, you know, 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre or Tibetan separatists or anything like that. It's just that they want the money in China to stay in China, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they, instead of people giving money to Facebook, they want to homebrew their own social network. Instead of people giving money to YouTube and Google, they want to create their own homebrew video.
Oh, so it's an economic consideration.
That's right. So that's something that most people don't really see, is because most people see the censorship thing as a human rights issue. In China, it is simply a commerce issue.
Probably part of the reason why the people don't necessarily object to it, because, you know, I mean, that sort of protectionist behavior is usually appealing to the mass of the people.
Exactly. But, I mean, you hit on the head. Basically, the U.S. has been trying to argue for China to drop censorship on trade issues, not human rights issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
Saying that U.S. companies don't have fair entry into the Chinese market with that censorship.
Mm-hmm.
What is your feeling, and you may, you know, it's a little bit different topic, but WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and is there such a thing as too much information? How do we navigate a world where you've got people like Julian Assange, who I think provide a service? I like that he takes on governments and exposes a lot of things, but where does that responsibility, where do you draw that line, and how do we deal with the fact that some information at the wrong time, even if it's truth, can put people's lives in danger, make it very difficult for intelligence agencies to operate in order to provide protection, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the funny thing about WikiLeaks is it first launched as inspired by Wikipedia, right? Even though, you know, folks who are in the know on Wikipedia have to keep telling people there's no connection between Wikipedia and WikiLeaks, because it's too easy to say, oh, Wikipedia, WikiBooks, WikiLeaks.
Yep.
Obviously,
yep.
You're all related. Not really.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all, actually. But, you know, Julian Assange took Wikipedia as an inspiration, saying lots of people with many eyeballs can do interesting things. And they abandoned the whole wiki model of, you know, anyone being able to upload anything at any time and anyone being able to read stuff, because of exactly what you said, is that this whole idea of, you know, an investigative journalism function is no good if, you know, you can't verify who gave it to you, if the person handing over data can't get any kind of protection in terms of identity or anonymity, things like that. So they tried the wiki model very, very early on, and they said, wait a minute, this is the wrong model. And they moved it to something else, even though they kept the name WikiLeaks, right?
Right.
So Assange, if you've seen, like, the Fifth Estate movie or seen the documentary, like, We Steal Secrets, did a pretty good job of explaining how WikiLeaks tried to do the right thing but probably was not as careful as they should have been in certain areas.
Mm.
But I think what you mentioned is right, is that overall, you know, WikiLeaks inspired other folks like Snowden to do what he did, or for people to really start a debate as to whether they wanted certain things being done in the name of the U.S. people, right? So I think that is something that's quite interesting to see, that Wikipedia inspired, you know, this model of openness. WikiLeaks couldn't really hold on to all the openness, but the idea of exposing things more to the public to understand what's going on in their name, I think that's an important
thing. What's your take on Snowden? What do you, how do you feel about about him?
Edward Snowden, I think overall, even if you don't like the individual or the tactics, has provided a huge service in terms of confirming a lot of the suspicions that people in technology and computer security circles have been thinking for a while. And the more that he reveals, the more you realize that the NSA has had a lot of fingers in some pretty fishy areas, you know, over the past decade or so. So I think one of the ones that is a little bit geeky and techy, but was really scary for a lot of folks in the technology world, is that the NSA actually paid money to one of the most prestigious cryptology and security firms called RSA to weaken the algorithms that people in the public used. That was a pretty big shocker.
Wow. Yeah.
Because when that company, RSA, started to recommend a certain type of cryptology standard, everyone, you know, computer scientists and people in the know said, what? Why would you recommend that? That's really weird. Why would you do that? And then only after Snowden revealed all the information about how the NSA, you know, basically paid RSA to do that, then everything came around and people said, oh, well, that's why.
Uh-huh. What has been done since then about that?
Well, the good thing about that is it's not, that's just one part of this whole encryption library that you can use. And most people saw it as so flawed that no one really ever used it seriously.
Oh, interesting. But
even though it was specified there, people said, that's just really weird, but it's such a terrible choice, we're not going to use it. But why would you recommend people use that? That's such a weird recommendation. And then only after the revelations came out did we all realize that, oh, that was because the NSA encouraged.
Because they were breaking the law, essentially?
I don't know enough in the legal sense whether they're breaking the law, but it certainly was a shocker.
You mean government overreaches? That's crazy talk. But mean government abuses their power? I've never heard of anything like that. But they're Americans. The Americans would never do that.
But the strange thing is that if it ever came to light, which it did, it would be so embarrassing and so silly to find out that the NSA did anything like that, and that's exactly what happened.
People I wish that Wikipedia had been around when the Vatican was shepherding child molesters from parish to parish. I mean, you know, listen, I'm not an angel, okay? But when I see how these central authorities behave, it's so appalling. If you're a man of the cloth, I'm not a very religious guy, you know, but I mean, it's just incredible to me. It is incredible. If you're a friend of mine and you're molesting children, I'm coming at you with everything I got because I'm a normal person. Because I'm what's called an ethical moral. It doesn't make me a hero. I think most of us would be like, oh, child molester, you should be in jail or dead. Not a big deal. a child rapist, etc., etc. And one of the things that I hope, and maybe you can comment on this, is that something like this Vatican scandal. They look so bad and they should just be in jail. But anyway, that kind of thing is going to be harder and harder to pull off, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been talking about is how, you know, in the age of Twitter, Facebook, and Wikipedia, and I consider Twitter and Wikipedia more like each other than Facebook, because Facebook, by default, is you need to
log in.
You need to log in and you need to allow people to participate and talk to you, whereas Twitter by default is open and wide and announcing and exchanging content. Wikipedia is by default, you know, everything is broadcast. And this is basically making what, you know, we're seeing as the new digital public sphere, right? This is the global debate and conversation so that we actually can hash out Twitter being kind of a real-time conversation, which has a lot of noise, but some signal, and Wikipedia is being kind of this permanent store of news and history that people collaborate on, is that maybe we can come to global consensus on things such as, you know, Israel and Palestine, or at least having an accurate history of that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, what is the total view of what the Catholic Church has done over the last 5, 10, 20, 100 years? Or how should we be looking at global warming or at Scientology and these types of things? And I think it is quite encouraging to see that Wikipedia, even if it's not perfect today, I think provides that platform for us to, you know, kind of converge on some version of the truth that everyone can agree on.
And I think that's the amazing thing, right, is that as you remove those barriers to conversation, it is amazing the degree to which consensus does emerge because of our shared humanity, our shared values. You know, we all want a better life for our children. We all want the opportunity to pursue, you know, financial success, to contribute to the world, all that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah. And I think what's curious about Wikipedia is that certain language editions do it better than others. And that's something that has been studied quite a bit. I think English language, because English is just so widely spoken across so many geographic boundaries, that English language Wikipedia, at least at this point, is one of the best examples of this global, you know, digital public sphere where you can actually come together because you have so many people of different backgrounds that speak English. The funny thing is, if you look at certain kind of isolated language or cultural groups, like Japanese or Russian, right? Pretty much anyone who speaks Japanese lives in Japan,
right?
Very few exceptions. That means that pretty much anyone who speaks Japanese, lives in Japan, has been through the same schooling system, has read the same textbooks, has experienced the same popular culture, so that if you actually read some of the articles in Japanese Wikipedia, they're not great when it comes to
there's not a lot on Nanking, for example.
Yeah, exactly. War crimes, you know, they're gonna have a little issue there.
Not us.
not to single them out.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's true.
But it's fascinating to see how, or to tell folks who don't know much about the different language editions, that it's not just English language Wikipedia, you know, is 4.4 million articles and all the other language editions are just translations. Oh, not at all. I mean, the funny thing is that each Wikipedia language edition takes on kind of the cultural characteristic or seen through the cultural lens of that language group. Hmm. So, you know, German, pretty good. French, pretty good, right? Because you have French speakers in Canada, you have French speakers in Europe, you've got French speakers in other places. But when you start to see these kind of siloed cultural language groups, it's really fascinating to see that their idea of neutrality is not like our idea of neutrality.
Yeah.
They don't have the same diversity of thought and viewpoints.
That's one of the frustrating things that I always think when I look at the Middle East, for example, how it waxes and wanes, how, you know, I mean, just take Iraq as an example. You've got a country with a tradition of essentially, well, first of all, it's tribal. And second of all, it's just so hard to share in power and resources because the history of doing so always means the other group, as soon as they get bigger guns, are going to take over. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's always been this tradition of a strong man with this cabal of, you know.
Well, that's been the tradition for the last couple of centuries. That's certainly not the tradition going back to the 1200s. I mean, the world's greatest library was in Baghdad.
Right, until the Mongols, those bastards came along and destroyed it. Yeah, but I'm just saying that It sometimes I get frustrated and worried that it's very difficult to break those cycles, although we saw it happen in South America. They were primarily military dictatorships, and they may be messy, but for the most part, most of South America or all of South America, including Central America, are pretty much democracies, or at least, you know, you can vote and people have their say, and certainly you have more freedoms than you did back in the day, even 30 years ago, 20 years ago. So I hope, and I wonder if you could, what you think, and if you're optimistic about the idea that maybe this idea called democracy and all the things that go with it, rule by the people and for the people and of the people, whether or not that's something that you think is catching on more so, that's part of the public debate in all these countries, including China?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to – I mean, it's great that today we actually have a lot of interesting pundits debating, you know, this whole idea of kind of the technological determinism of whether the Internet and these technologies that embrace this free flow of conversation and Wikipedia, you know, kind of archiving and writing history together, whether that can overcome bad governments and bad governance to actually just make democracy inevitable. I'd like to think that, but I'm a little bit more sober about those predictions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Evgeny Morozov is a famous guy who just kind of shoots down that argument left and right, saying that as much as we think that the individuals and the small folks can use mobile phones and Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and Wikipedia to mobilize and to, you know, make an example of bad governments to affect social change, those same technologies can be used by oppressive governments to you know, make their side stronger as well. So
I don't know, though. Maybe, but I mean, when you've got that many people with a camera phone and they're filming a bunch of soldiers kicking somebody to death or whatever,
But why did Ayatollah Khomeini come to power? Ayatollah Khomeini came to power because he was the first person to really take advantage of the cassette tape. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's about who's the early mover, who's the early adopter, and what's it being used for.
Yeah, right, right. Mm-hmm. I think you're seeing in Egypt, it's a little bit messier than we thought, right? So that the revolution was great in terms of, you know, Twitter and YouTube allowing for, you know, the little people to really say, you know, we want it this way. But on the other hand, you know, what you're seeing shake out right now in Egypt is really messy, and it's not clear. Yeah. Information communication technologies will solve that anytime soon.
Yeah.
But in terms of the case of the Middle East and Arabic languages, Arabic culture, I'm fairly optimistic that, you know, Arabic language Wikipedia has done a pretty good job and will play a pretty pivotal role in helping the situation there. And one of the research projects that I'd seen recently, it was done out of Harvard and kind of showed the influence of Arabic Wikipedia and Al Jazeera in that area shows that it doesn't matter whether you have Arabic language speakers and bloggers and Wikipedia editors, whether they're in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or wherever they are, they all kind of see Al Jazeera as a reputable news source, but they also see Wikipedia as the reputable knowledge base across those places, which is really amazing.
That's huge.
Yeah.
So, you know, Al Jazeera is well-funded. It's kind of, you know, patterned off the BBC. It's definitely a top-down editorial product as a news outlet, but it has immense respect even among, you know, secularized or religious Arabic speakers around that area. But you see the Arabic language Wikipedia also has that same level of respect, and, you know, it's growing. You've got places like the, you know, the new library at Alexandria helping to digitize text so that they can be uploaded into Wikipedia in the Arabic language edition to improve the quality of articles and Arabic history. So it's encouraging in many ways. I just hope that it can be used to affect positive change there.
Well, one of the interesting things that I talk, you know, the function of language to essentially act as an isolating factor for the movement of ideas, I think is really interesting. I mean, the UN Human Development Report on the Arab World, number 2, was about basically how do you create an information society in the Arab world. Right. And one of the statistics that they cited there was that since the year 1000, the same number of books have been translated into Arabic as are translated into Spanish in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
wow.
And, you know, the other example they gave, which I just thought was mind-blowing, was, you know, there are about 10 million speakers of Greek.
Yeah.
There are, you know, hundreds of millions of speakers of Arabic, but there are 5 times as many books translated into Greek as into Arabic every year.
Wow.
So, and you know, that's the thing is that a lot of these ideas aren't necessarily available. And I think one of the things that's so interesting is so much of that is being driven by the traditional economics of publishing. Something like Arabic language Wikipedia means that, you know, you don't have to worry about, oh, am I going to sell a print run of, you know, 10,000 books?
Mm. Right. Right. That's a great point. I mean, that's one of the interesting projects that, you know, we had the Wikipedia conference, which is called Wikimania, back in 2008 in Alexandria, Egypt, for exactly this reason. We really wanted to kind of show that Wikipedia was interested in helping the growth of Arabic language Wikipedia in that region. And we toured through that library, and they're actually scanning the text and trying to get more things online for exactly the reasons you said, that there just has been a dearth of online Arabic language source text to even write Wikipedia on, as the primary sources for writing that. So that's really a challenge because, you know, the same way that English language Wikipedia has progressed to the point where it's demanding references and web links for every little thing that's added to Wikipedia to make it more reliable, you really can't even do that for Arabic language Wikipedia. There's just not enough online to prove certain things in Arabic language Wikipedia, so they've had to kind of, you know, take a step back and use a lower standard for writing articles in Wikipedia because of that.
Give us an idea. Take us through the origins of Wikipedia. Whose idea was it? Has anybody gotten rich from it? besides you, Andrew.
No. I haven't gotten rich. That is an interesting question, right? So the origins of Wikipedia start with a company called Bomas.com. So I think anyone who's used Wikipedia has seen the beautiful mugshot of Jimmy Wales asking for donations at the top of a Wikipedia page. So Jimmy Wales and a few other folks started a company that was just like pretty much any other .com at the time. They were trying different things. They were trying to make a clone of Yahoo. If you remember, Yahoo had a directory of stuff. There was no real search engine back then that was the number one search engine. They were trying different things, and then part of what they wanted to do was to create an encyclopedia, a for-profit encyclopedia called Newpedia, N-U-P-E-D-I-A. And just like pretty much anyone else at the time, they said, if we want to create an encyclopedia, we obviously need an editor-in-chief, and we need to come up with some kind of formal structure and process, and we need to, even though if we're going to make it volunteer-driven, we need to make sure that these people prove that they're smart enough to do this. So when they created Newpedia, they hired one guy exactly, Larry Sanger. He was a PhD student in philosophy, and basically said, you're the editor-in-chief. You're going to corral volunteers. Even though we're a .com, we are going to allow anyone to copy our content. We still own the copyright, but we'll let anyone copy the content. So they were pretty stringent in terms of who could contribute. They need to prove that they had a college degree, and they had a 7-step process for doing this. And to be fair to them, pretty much I think anyone you'd ask at the time said, yeah, you probably need those kind of rigorous standards. And after 1 year production, or lack thereof, they generated a total of 12 articles with with maybe another few dozen in the works, but they only completed 12 articles through the 7-step process.
Amazing.
You know,
proposal, draft, second draft, copy editing.
God, academics, they're so careful. Yeah. You ever ask an academic a question about something they don't, they're not a total expert on, they're like, I can't really speak on that subject, but I have heard. Yeah.
Right. And you think that, okay, the articles you want to get through very quickly are things like earth, dog, cat,
exactly.
Wood, tree. The first article was on atonality, a musical concept. So that's kind of
fascinating. That's fascinating.
So, you know, they're shooting kind of high in terms of academic quality there. So they realized after 1 year and 12 articles, this was not going to scale, and that was not a good idea to stick with this 7-step process. So what they start to look at in the technology world was that there are computer programmers and geeks using this piece of software called a wiki. And it was just simply a way for computer programmers to share their code, saying, hey, I spent half an hour solving this problem. I'm going to upload my computer code, and anyone who wants to can download that code, use it, and improve it, and upload their code. So it's a way for computer programmers to share info. And they said, well, why don't we try this wiki software just to start articles? We're still going to use Newpedia as the finishing part of things, but if we just put this wiki software on there, maybe, you know, like bees going to a new hive, people will come along and start articles and we'll finish them. And they realized within 3 months, you know, people were completing not just 12 articles, but, you know, dozens of articles.
Wow.
Not just starting them, but copy editing them and completing those articles. And they realized
that's
very quickly.
That's very interesting from a human nature point of view. It's really interesting to me that some people would be like, I know about this and I'm going to take the time to write an article about this and post it. You know, it's interesting. It's kind of like it's surprising to me, isn't it? I mean,
it is and it isn't. And one of the things I tried to explain in my book was that it was the right project at the right time. And I think there's two major factors to this. One is that they really did appeal to a community that was used to spending a lot of their free time doing stuff with no monetary reward.
Okay.
So. It's often called the wiki, the encyclopedia that Slashdot built. And for folks who don't know about Slashdot, it's very popular, very dedicated set of folks who, you know, read tech news and discuss news about geek topics and science and things like that.
Thank God for nerds, by the way. God.
Nerd power, right?
I mean, seriously. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the tagline for Slashdot. It's called News for Nerds. And what's interesting about it is it's not, I mean, it was basically a blog before there were even blogs, right? Slashdot's a really old community. But the cool thing about it is that the people who write Slashdot were also programming geeks. So they actually created a very fancy commenting system so that you could actually have discussions but have participants in the conversation filter out junk, right? So if you saw people were obviously trolling or making lewd comments, you could, as a participant, help filter out those folks and delete those comments, things like that. So you already had in Slashdot a community that cared about signal and getting rid of noise. And when you posted, or when they posted into Slashdot, hey, by the way, we've got this thing called Wikipedia. We invite you guys to try writing stuff here. You had all these folks from Slashdot who are used to doing things for free and wanted high signal, and they saw, this is really cool. This is using the wiki, and I've used a wiki, and you start to see, you know, hundreds of people get involved with that not quite overnight, but very quickly. Within weeks, you had lots and lots of activity there. And it convinced the folks doing Newpedia, wow, we've got something on our hands here. We don't even need Newpedia anymore. They're doing the entire article lifecycle in Wikipedia.
Man.
It's mind-blowing. God. It's really mind-blowing. And that's what's so amazing is, yeah, when you go through the book, you're just kind of like, you know, it really does. I mean, the Wikipedia revolution really does sort of restore your faith in humanity.
I was going to say, it does. It makes me feel positive
about things. It's amazing.
Well, if you want something even more positive, look at the top 50 most popular websites in the world.
Right? Mm-hmm. BrianCallen.com.
Yeah.
But, you know,
Google second.
Wikipedia is depending on what survey you look at, is fifth or sixth in terms of most popular web properties in the world.
What are the top five?
The top five commonly cited in the top three. The only three that are firmly ensconced in the top five are Google, Yahoo, Microsoft. Okay. Those are the big ones.
Microsoft.
Microsoft, yeah. Well, I mean, that's mainly because everyone needs to update their computers and stuff like that. So why they get a lot of traffic, right?
Right.
But those are multi-billion dollar companies, right?
Yeah.
And Wikipedia is right up there. If you look at the other companies on that list, there's really no nonprofits. There are no non-commercial sites up there. So Wikipedia really is, as you said, you know, kind of restores your faith in humanity. It's the only site in that top 50 or even maybe top 100 that is a no-commerce zone. It is where you get information and you're not inundated with junk and crap and ads and things like that.
It's incredible.
We really are at this fascinating turning point in history where we've sort of been operating under democracy for a couple of hundred years now, but now we're seeing like these massively decentralized approaches that essentially have figured out how to recreate the agora of ancient Athens.
Right.
You know what I mean? Not representative democracy, but true democracy, direct democracy. And I think that's what's so great when you read this book is that it's so tantalizing because you actually start to feel like direct democracy with this technology can actually work again on a global scale.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think it really is the only place where you can really see a glimmer of hope of, you know, being really independent of commercial pressures, of never having to sell out principles, of people really determining the direction of this, regardless of their background, regardless of the education level, regardless of where they came from. You know, it is really quite fascinating to see. The question for this community going forward is, they've had a great, you know, at this point, 13-year run. Is there another 13 years in it for them?
Well, it strikes me, though, as I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
Because you just, before I forget that kind of raised an interesting point to me. You know, it's one thing to have access to information at your fingertips. It's another thing to be a learned person, somebody with knowledge, perspective, understanding, the ability to distinguish between the meaning, to know the difference, to appreciate the meaningful difference between things. In short, to be educated, to immerse yourself in the best that's been thought and said, and then to glean from that, you know, the best way to move forward in your life. that's still lacking, like you said, even in China. You know, we're more interested in twerking and things like that and things that sparkle on the surface. Might be a good thing. It probably means we have enough to eat and we have leisure time. But the challenge, it seems to me, for Wikipedia and for this new revolution in information is to figure out a way to educate people in a cheap and efficient way. Right now, college still costs a lot of money. Private school for your children costs a lot of money, et cetera, et cetera. Is anybody working on the bridge, on that bridge between the information that's available and getting that information into the brains of the people that never are not interested in education? Hunter's raising his hand.
I am.
Andrew, take a side. Stand down, Andrew. Go ahead, Hunter.
Well, no, but I mean, what I was going to say is so much of what you're talking about, Andrew, is that, you know, the tech community is really enamored of the idea that technology is going to solve education. You know, there's been a flood of venture capital into all of these ed tech startups.
Right.
You know, we see the Khan Academy and, you know, everybody's very excited by all the videos that are on there. And we're giving iPads to kids. And, you know, fundamentally what you're talking about with all of these language communities is that the real barriers to the movement of ideas and information are not technological, they're psychological. you know, it's getting the 96% really engaged in the process of knowledge creation. It's making those ideas accessible to people who speak, you know, languages that are, you know, culturally and politically isolated. It's really about getting not getting an internet connection to someone's home, but, you know, opening the doors of perception.
Hello. I just went to the Khan Academy, by the way. Don't even know anything about it, but thank you. K-H-A-N Academy.
Right.
Started by Andrew Lee. guys, I'm sorry for this interruption, but this is how we get paid. So I'm going to do a commercial, but it is a product I believe in, as always. I am here to talk about Sherry's Berries. They are giant, freshly dipped in chocolate strawberries. Okay. And they start at $19.99. Okay. And you can get over 40% savings or double the berries for just $10 more. All you need is my code, Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, C-A-L-L-E-N. For your order. And I'll tell you how to do that in a second. But here's the bottom line. There are two things that are never bad for you. You can talk to any nutritionist in the world. Chocolate and berries. Put them together. And I'm talking about you can get white chocolate. You can get milk chocolate. You can get dark chocolate. You can get swirls. You can get nuts on them. I just ate one because they didn't want me to sell their product without me testing it. They literally were like, we want him to eat the berries first. We want to eat, you know, so that he believes in the product. That says a lot about a company. And I got to be honest, I'm very happy to say that they were delicious. I was going to take just one bite because, you know, I'm like, I don't want any more. I don't know sugar for me. And then I finished the whole thing. So this is how you get it. Here's where you get an amazing Valentine's Day deal, okay? Giant, freshly dipped in chocolate strawberries starting at $19.99, okay? Or you can get double the berries for just $10 more. All you have to do is visit berries.com, berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right corner and type in Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, and you will get a great deal. Offer ends on Thursday, so hurry.
No, I mean, I think you've hit on some really important things. I mean, the whole idea of MOOCs, right, the massively online, you know, courses and everything, it's fascinating to see all the activity in those areas. I think this past year we've seen a lot of shakeout in that area, too, saying that, you know, we had our euphoria, we're now trying to assess the effectiveness of them, mm-hmm. and they're looking at rates of retention and the rates of people actually finishing those courses, and it's actually pretty low. I don't think it means that we should abandon these experiments, but it does mean that we are past the, you know, euphoria stage or build it and they will come. We now need to be a little bit more discriminating about those things. But I think what Brian asked about before is really important too, which is, you know, great, we have all these Wikipedia articles, there's great knowledge in here, but they're standalone articles. Are there things that we could be doing more of with these articles to make them into more learning experiences or packages? And they've tried some of these experiments in the Wikipedia community. There was something, there still is, but I think it's stalled, something called Wikiversity. So the idea is, how can you use the wiki method to maybe create mini courses within the Wikipedia universe where you recommend articles to read and you actually have the crowd help craft exercises or to go online to do something? And that's been much harder to achieve because no one has a clear vision for what a Wikiversity would look like or what a...
Well, you need a little pop-up window with somebody twerking.
But on their ass is imprinted a vocab word.
That's right. That's true. Yeah, it's basically nobody really wants to do the work. It's
yeah. But, you know, what's really cool is that Wikipedia in the last few years has had a really amazing turnaround in terms of perception by experts and folks in culture institutions. So one of the big moments in 2010 that happened, at least in the English language Wikipedia world, was that the British Museum kind of woke up to the fact that Wikipedia has a lot more readers about cultural artifacts that the British Museum owns than people who actually go to the museum, right? Mm-hmm. So people are looking up on Wikipedia the Rosetta Stone article, and the number of people who read Rosetta Stone in Wikipedia is a much greater number than actually visit the Rosetta Stone, something that they own in the museum. And they realized then that it's in the interest of museums and cultural institutions to work with Wikipedia to improve the articles, but also maybe for museums to use Wikipedia content to improve the experience of people who go to that museum or visit the website. So they invited a Wikipedian in residence for 3 months, a Wikipedia editor to kind of live in the museum for 3 months, to work with curators there to improve content in Wikipedia, but also to have Wikipedia, Wikipedia folks work with the museum to find out how they
can go forward.
And, you know, the museum world is a very monkey-see-monkey-do kind of world. So once the British Museum had a Wikipedian in residence, pretty much everyone else rushed to want to incorporate Wikipedia into what they were doing. So one of the classes I'm doing this semester in Washington, D.C., is an entire class, a whole 15-week class, where we take 20 students and we're training them to be, you know, expert Wikipedia editors. And then every other week, we're going down to the Smithsonian or the National Archives, and we're working with the curators of those cultural institutions. So next week, we're going to the American Art Museum and working with them to improve entire swaths of articles that are lacking or even missing in Wikipedia related to American artists. So I think that's an exciting area where Wikipedia is not just a standalone website with knowledge, but we're actually working with the experts in the same room to actually craft other types of content around that. Maybe kind of a multimedia, you know, introduction to all the significant artists, American artists. Or Wikipedia is now working on a whole multimedia initiative to put more video and interactives into Wikipedia. That's something that most people who've used Wikipedia probably realized after using it for a year or so, wait a minute, I've never seen a video in Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Why
is
that?
Yeah.
Right? It's actually very multimedia poor. So why doesn't Wikipedia have more, 2 to 3 minute documentary, mini documentaries to explain a topic, or interactive to show you how a steam engine works? And it's not something it does right now.
A big question that I have, because I think what's so fascinating is, you were one of the first .com entrepreneurs. Andrew actually ran a company that was www.ny.com. Like, he owned NY as in New York.
I didn't know
com.
That.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing.
He's probably calling us from his mansion.
Not quite.
But you've operated in the world of technology for a good long while. You've been involved in so much decentralized stuff. But then at the same time, you've also been a professor at USC, at Columbia.
He's got a big brain.
He
owns New York, and he has a big brain.
but what I was going to say is, the decentralized nature of Wikipedia. But then, you still also have a foot in the very established, for lack of a better word, ivory tower world of traditional academia. What do you think is the future of the university? What is the future of a degree when everybody can take a part in writing the world's greatest encyclopedia?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the irony of the whole thing, is that I'm one of the folks who probably believes that it's more likely than not the traditional university as we know it is going to come down quite hard, the same way newspapers crumbled in the face of the dot-com revolution. I don't see that with any kind of pleasure, or I don't see it as inevitable either, but I do see it as an exciting challenge to be within the university to help them move to a place where they won't be run over as roadkill by what is happening with knowledge online with Wikipedia or crowdsourcing, the creation of learning resources, or what even museums and other cultural institutions are doing to, provide lifelong learning that might challenge what universities do. That's why I do think that what Khan Academy and Coursera and these folks doing massive online learning initiatives is really good in terms of you need lots of ideas, you need lots of failure before you get to where that's going to happen. And unfortunately, most universities don't like the word failure, right? But that's why most of these initiatives are happening on the West Coast, where failure is worn like a badge of honor. Whereas on the East Coast, failure means you stink and I don't think you should ever start a company anymore, right? So there's a big cultural gap between traditional universities and what they consider valid experimentation and what is acceptable in terms of try, fail, and try again. I'm hopeful that some universities will get it, but this, even before this, dot-com revolution, it was clear that the U.S. had probably too many four-year universities for its own good, or four-year colleges for its own good. We have a weird thing in the U.S. where we say four-year universities are the secret to everything, and two-year colleges and community colleges are for losers and people who don't know how to do things. I think that's completely wrong. I think if you look in Europe, you have folks who go to two-year colleges and don't learn Plato and don't learn how to write academic papers, and they do great, and they are really, really useful and necessary for society. And I think in the U.S., if we can get past that, four-year degree is the universal key to unlock your future, and there's lots of different things that you can do in between. I think if we can get there, we'd be much better off.
Man, 4 years and you can't tear it up and get drunk. What a bummer. Man, you are the death of fun, brother.
You're killing fraternities,
dude. Andrew Lee, the author of Wikipedia, The Wikipedia Revolution, How a Bunch of Nobodies Created the World's Greatest Encyclopedia. It's a great book. We're going to put it on our website. And Andrew, you are one of those people that's making a difference. We appreciate you joining us here, man. It's been fun.
Yeah, thanks a lot. This has been fun.
Yeah, man. What's your next book?
So I'm working on another book on the Wikipedia effect. So you hinted about it a little bit, which is, you know, what has Wikipedia taught us beyond the fact that the crowd can make a nice written encyclopedia? So by now, pretty much everyone knows that you can use the crowdsourcing method for mapping, right, or for traffic reporting. But what can we do now beyond that? So what has Wikipedia taught us about how crowds can do great things that Ooh. You never thought could be done?
I like it. Write the book. We'll read it. We'll get you back on. Thank you so much. And by the way, everybody, if you like stand-up comedy, if you like to laugh, I'm just saying, Brian Kid Callen, that's me. I'll be in New York at the Gotham Comedy Club February 21st, 22nd, 23rd. Then I'm in San Francisco at the Punchline February 27th, 28th, and March 1st. Andrew, you're down in D.C., aren't you?
But you're going to come up to New York City.
Of course
City.
He's going to. If he has to get up there by horseback, he'll do it.
Well, next time you're in D.C., let me know. We'll tour you through American U, the new version.
I'm looking forward to it, my friend. Thanks so much. You're a man.
Take care.
All right, bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.